Welcome to FIC Focus, where Bloomberg Intelligence fixed income, credit currency, and commodities strategists and analysts discuss their short and long-term views on debt markets and issuers. Now, here's the Bloomberg Intelligence FIC research team.
Masters of the Universe. I'm Eric Kozatsky, head of municipal strategy here at Bloomberg Intelligence, and joined as always by Karen Altamirano, also of Muni BI. So this month, we are again joined by an asset manager, and we actually get to do this one on the road since we're traveling on the West Coast this month, right now in San Francisco. And we're joined by Ben Barber from Franklin Templeton. For those of you who don't know, Ben is the Senior Vice President and Director of Franklin Templeton Fixed Income and Municipal Bonds here in San Mateo, California, right outside San Francisco. Ben is the head of Municipal Bond Funds at Franklin Templeton and is the Portfolio Manager for all National Municipal Strategies. Again, for those of you who aren't familiar with Ben, he has over 30 years of experience in financial services and also a member of Franklin Templeton's management committee. And prior to coming to Franklin Templeton, he was the co-head of muni bonds at Goldman Sachs Asset Management. And interestingly enough, and I actually learned this on the car ride over to Franklin Templeton, he was with them and toward the beginning of his career. So a round tripper. And as someone who's round tripped back to Bloomberg, I can certainly appreciate going back home to a place that you really like working at. So Ben, welcome. I'm happy that you could join us today.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, we're obviously in a year with a lot of volatility from a macro standpoint, and there's a lot to talk about that's impacting our market from areas that I don't think anyone was really considering late December or even January. So let's just sort of, you know, talk about the big thing that, you know, can really impact our market. And not asking who you're voting for or even who we actually think the candidates are going to be for either side, but let's focus from a tax standpoint. How important is this election to the future of the muni market? It's a really heavy question, right?
it's a big question, and it's a great one. It's really interesting. We get asked a lot what we care about from the perspective of elections, and you know, voting either at the federal level or at the state and local level. Is it, you know, bond initiatives and referendums? Is it, you know, change to legislation? You know, what are the big ticket items that we really care about? And it's really interesting, you know, thinking about the last several election cycles, it really depends on if we're talking about federal elections or if we're talking about state and local elections. And one of the key determinants there is, you know, when we think about federal elections, I think one of the most important things for the market is just to have some sort of a calming effect. And generally that takes place with divided government. You know, unified government is pretty tough for the markets overall to, you know, to get comfortable with. Whether you, you know, agree or disagree is irrelevant. But, you know, united government generally means, you know, there's going to be some legislation that gets done. And that is a, it can be a disarming thing for the markets. You know, divided government at the federal level feels okay generally for the markets because it generally means not a lot of change is coming. There won't be a tremendous amount of legislation, and usually that's a calming effect for the markets, both stock and bond markets. So that's interesting. You know, quite different than how we think about state, you know, government elections. There, you know, we're really rooting for united government, because the most important thing, or one of the most important things that takes place at the state level, is of course passing a budget, getting a balanced budget done, which has to be done everywhere across the country in every state, with the exception of Vermont, that doesn't require a balanced budget. But it's very interesting. And again, agree or disagree with the future or the direction of that political structure, but having a unit, you know, a united government between executive branch and legislative branch makes the budget process much, much easier. We've seen it, you know, a lot of different times. Illinois is the most probably extreme example, you know, of that as of late. And, you know, you see what happens with the united government. A budget gets done very, very easily, whereas with divided government, it can be extraordinarily difficult and massively delayed. So it's a really interesting, you know, difference that we think about here in municipals with regard to, you know, the voting cycle and elections in particular.
You know, we're looking at it from a strategy standpoint as far as what's on the chopping block and what could change potentially, right, from that legislative standpoint, right? And we have some things that are coming up that are expiring, namely some provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. You know, how much is that in the focus of your team right now as far as some of the changes?
Yeah, it's definitely in the focus, but I would say it's on the margin. It's really interesting when we think about tax changes that have been put in place that have actually been meaningful for muni to treasury valuation, which is really what we're getting here to with, you know, with tax changes. The whole question is it enough to deserve a difference in valuations between munis and treasuries or munis and corporates, munis versus other high quality fixed income? And the answer is it's got to be a really, really big change to the tax code to actually make a meaningful difference. I think back to, you know, when Steve Forbes was running, this was 1995, and he was going on the platform of flat tax. And that would have been a significant change to income tax rates at the time. And it was enough to actually change valuations of munis to treasuries at that time when Steve Forbes sort of was in the hunt. When it became clear he was not, that went away and away we go. But I think a change from, you know, 35% to 39% or back to 35% and, you know, et cetera, you know, within that type of a range, it's not really enough to change the valuation of munis to treasuries.
So one thing that could change sort of those ratios and those valuations, and while it's not an expiring provision, it is something that's probably going to be in whichever candidate's eyesight, is changes to the corporate tax rate, right? Because that's a buyer that's really sort of been absent in our market for several years now. You know, are you sort of considering that as something that is actually has a potential to, you know, increase and bring that buyer back in?
Yeah, you bet. And that is a significant buyer when it's attractive, you know, for them to cross into tax exempt munis. And so, yeah, that does have the potential to be a difference maker. And I sort of shudder to think, just given how, you know, powerful the technical environment is right now in tax exempts, I shudder to think what it'll feel like if we have another significant buyer coming in.
Yep.
In the form of banks. But yes, that does have the potential to make a difference.
So, you know, talk to us real quick about fund flows, everyone's sort of favorite topic when it comes to the muni market, right? And I want to come at it from the aspect that, you know, while you said changes in that tax rate are really on the margin, for people who are paying taxes, it feels like a big deal, especially high net worth individuals who are looking to put some money to work and obviously protect it from taxes. So if we have a change to the top tax rate, and, you know, obviously the top tax rate in California in itself is going up again, right? So you have that double whammy effect there. Are you seeing more outreach from clients, more of that reverse inquiry to talk about how to protect some of that income?
Yeah, there's no question. We've had a tremendous amount of demand, a tremendous amount of requests coming in for information and getting organized on the muni market for those that are either already invested in tax exempt munis or those that want to get invested in tax exempt munis. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the big hang up here over the last couple of years now at this point is the inverted yield curve. And of course, what that has meant for, you know, people keeping money in cash and cash equivalents. And that's been a significant drag, of course, on the demand side for, you know, pushing out the curve a little bit into even short term and intermediate and of course market duration types of munis. So yes, there is a tremendous amount of demand out there for tax exempt income, but it's being, you know, incredibly held back by virtue of the inverted yield curve.
You know, it's interesting. So one of our favorite tables, not a chart, it's more of a table that Karen actually puts together. I think it's really interesting. We look at sort of in-state tax rates in high tax enclaves, namely like New York, New Jersey, California. And then we look at it versus national options. And then we look at it versus treasuries on a tax equivalent yield basis. And I think a lot of people were really surprised, even in this high ratio environment, how advantageous it really was to buy in-state bonds for California. that you were just out yielding treasuries by the magnitude of like 100 basis points on the long end of the curve. Are you surprised that that's still held up as much, given sort of how robust demand has been for a lot of the retail structures?
Yeah, I really am. We certainly thought that, you know, the demand would be really, really significant at this point in terms of flows. We see it in SMA, of course, everybody does. So that has remained positive, and actually for our business, and I'm sure we're a very good proxy for the other large asset managers out there, it was positive every single month through 2022 when open-end funds were getting, you know, record-breaking redemptions. So there's clearly a lot of demand in the SMA space, but I certainly would have thought by now the demand would have been very significant into open-end funds. Again, the inversion of the yield curve is clearly what's holding it back. From my perspective, I think that's actually a really, really strong positive catalyst for technicals going forward in the muni market. If our curve gets back to, you know, flat or much more normal upward sloping nature to the yield curve, I think it's, you know, demand will be really, really strong into all formats of munis at that point.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. It's a nice segue because we had the time, since we got a taste of California rush hour traffic this morning on the way to your office, to talk in the car about how inverted the yield curve is. And
we were wondering, what is there any drop in rates that could uninvert the curve?
Any sort of Fed action at this point, right? Because they're certainly telegraphing a willingness to sort of let this run hot.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, obviously, it would have to be a massive amount of cut that certainly the market is not anticipating anytime soon. And so, you know, I think all of these bets have clearly been pushed off. The market was very, very quick to react to, you know, much hotter inflation than forecast last week. And so we're feeling the full brunt of that right now. You know, I think that it's got to happen from both sides of the equation. I think, you know, Fed funds rates need to come down eventually for this yield curve to get back normal. And that also insinuates a little bit more of a sell-off in the, you know, 5, 10, 20 year portion of the yield curve.
I saw some comments this morning that, you know, sort of on face value, I thought they were confusing, but then I sort of thought on it a little bit more and it actually made a lot of sense. Someone had said this morning that the high rate environment is actually the primary fuel and for inflation, right? And they sort of quantitatively derived that conclusion. It was one of the bigger banks said this. And I thought it was interesting, wanted to get your take on it, right? So is this almost a case of like the calls coming from inside the house, right? We have hot inflation that keeps running and it's really because rates are higher and they refuse to drop them.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting when you think about, you know, the overall inflation numbers that get printed, and then you think about the real inflation numbers that, you know, individuals in this country are feeling, which is, of course, inflation that you see at the grocery store and you see at the gas pump and all that stuff. But you're also very, very significantly seeing that in your car loans and in your home loans that have reset and that sort of thing. And so when you think about true inflation for an individual, you absolutely should work in the fact that borrowing costs are much, much higher at the end than they were 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And that is certainly a consideration when you're thinking about real inflation to individuals.
Yeah. It's interesting, at least like muni borrowers for now still get the benefit of borrowing at those exempt rates. So they're not feeling the true brunt of what some of these corporate borrowers have to sort of bear with, right? When they go to market and have to borrow, you know, large copious amounts of money. You know, I want to sort of use that as a jumping off point, because one of the things that has sort of come up from other strategists and other shops is this sort of quasi argument that the exemption's never been under more threat. And I sort of wanted to ask you, is there any thought in your mind that that's actually going to be something for the market to contend with at any point this year?
Yeah, I think that's one of the main reasons. You hit on a really good point, which is, you know, what is the major threat to municipals always is what happens if the tax exemption gets taken away. And, you know, one of the reasons why our ratio curve has always been steep, if you think about the muni to treasury, you know, ratio curve, that's very upward sloping and always has been. And I think one of the main reasons there is, you know, you've got additional risk as you push out the curve that tax exemption will be taken away, you know, much higher risk 10, 20, 30 years from now than you have, you know, in the next couple of years. And so that's always been, I think, you know, from my perspective, it's been factored into the market, not fully, of course, but factored in. But we do know that anytime that topic of taking away tax exemption from municipal bonds has gotten any sort of traction, it very, very quickly gets squashed by, you know, every governor, every treasurer around the country. And, you know, that pretty quickly gets bipartisan support saying, you can't take away tax exemption from munis. You're going to kill the cost of capital for all these municipalities. And that's how we fund infrastructure in this country. So what are we really doing at the end of the day?
Correct.
So from my perspective, I think it's very, very much a long shot that tax exemption gets taken away. But it's clearly, you know, a topic that comes up every so often and is open to debate.
So one of the areas that I sort of, I'll say the quiet part out loud, right? Higher education had a lot of bad press last year, let's be honest, for a lot of reasons we don't really need to delve into, but they had a lot of headlines and a lot of attention from Congress for things that I think were sort of unintended consequences. So my question to you would be, if there was any part of the muni market that had the exemption taken away, do you think that higher ed could be one place where we could see that pulled back?
Absolutely. There are lots of challenges that are constantly taking place. You know, people don't really like to see, you know, nonprofit organizations with a, you know, a massive, massive endowment. That, you know, doesn't really feel great, especially if that university is surrounded by, a location that could really use those property tax revenues or any other sort of tax revenues that could be derived from, you know, from the university. So I think it'll be continued to be challenged. I think there are, you know, a lot of one-off negotiations that have taken place, you know, over the last 10 to 15 years with some institutions and that'll continue. That's going to continue to be a bone of contention, with those situations for sure.
So I'm happy that you agreed with me, but then I want to use that to sort of segue into my next point. Are you surprised that given that risk that's sort of hanging out there, that we really haven't seen a meaningful widening of spreads in that sector, right? To sort of compensate for that unknown.
Well, when we look at that sector, the higher ed sector, we break it down in a lot of different divisions. And, you know, clearly the area with the most stress within higher ed has been the small, you know, private, you know, mostly liberal arts colleges that have a very small student body, a much smaller endowment. You know, we see the same theme playing out in many of these institutions where you have a higher and higher acceptance rate, a lower and lower matriculation rate. You've got a higher and higher tuition discount rate, and it's
the warning bells. Yeah.
Really, really tough cycle. And you see the downgrades, you've seen, you know, quite a few defaults, either technical or actually actual defaults. You've seen mergers, acquisitions, you've seen some schools that are not appropriate for an acquisition from another school. So it's a very difficult sector when you get down to that level of size. You know, the very, very large institutions, you know, and we all know who they are, the AAA universities, you know, continue to have a massive amount of demand and can withstand, you know, quite a bit of pain and quite a bit of taxes if it comes down to that.
Sure.
But yeah, the smaller universities have clearly widened out, you know, and so we have seen spread really react in that portion of the higher ed, but it really, you know, takes the getting into the details of the different types of higher ed institutions out there to really see that spread widening.
You know, that's one of the reasons these smaller liberal arts schools, why I think they wouldn't wholesale take away the exemption for higher education, because you would almost create a bifurcated market of haves and have nots of like who could withstand the punishment of, you know, sort of higher borrowing costs and paying on those property taxes, right? And sort of like further break apart that sector. So I'm banking on that it's not going to happen, but who knows, you know, as far as what could change in the coming year.
It's a very slippery slope because, you know, you can obviously start there. You can work your way over to
hospitals
lots of different sectors within the municipal market, including acute care, you know, nonprofit hospitals for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
So I want to pivot to fund flows. You know, we've seen that fund flows continue to appear to be lagging this year so far. So I wanted to know, do you see that turning around at all later this year?
Well, I sure hope so. It has been a very long slog of redemptions, really, you know, starting very beginning of 2022. And here we're specifically talking about open-end funds.
Correct.
2022, as we all know, is a record-breaking outflow cycle out of open-end funds. We calculate it to have been around a 15% redemption cycle, you know, roughly $150 billion out on a base of about $1 trillion at the beginning of 2022 for the open-end fund world. And so that's really big, you know, thinking about, you know, prior years, you know, over the prior 10, 15, 20 years, even thinking about really tough years like 1994 or, 99, even the fall of 2010, taper tantrum in 13, you know, you've had some really tough times in munis. Never have you had anything approaching a 15% redemption cycle out of the open end fund world. So 22 was really, really tough. 23, you know, had a lot of volatility in it, but, you know, overall continued to be, you know, negative overall for the open end fund world. And here we are in 24, and it's sort of been, you know, roughly even, maybe slightly positive, but very, very small, you know, in the grand scheme of things. So it's been a tough go for open end funds. You know, we've seen a lot of money transfer over to the SMA world. Of course, we've seen quite a bit going into, you know, a handful of ETFs.
Yep.
And I'm sure there's a lot of individual bond buying, you know, going on out there as well. With the open end fund world, you know, question from the most extreme would be, is it dead? And I think, no, of course it's not dead. I think there's a lot of really, really strong arguments to say the open end fund world of muni bonds is still very, very relevant. There are a lot of very, very good products out there. The products work well from the perspective of, you know, daily liquidity and, you know, the ability to reinvest and or get paid out in dividends is, you know, it is, you know, very, very well known. Many of the open end funds are sitting out there with lots and lots of realized capital loss carry forwards. That is very handy, you know, asset really that a lot of these open end funds have. So, you know, I think there's a lot of very reasonable open end funds out there that will still really appeal to many, many clients. But, you know, I think it's undeniable the amount of demand for SMA, the amount of demand for ETFs is clearly quite different than it was 5, 10, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And so, you know, of course, we all acknowledge that.
No, I was just going to say, do you attribute that shift solely to the chase for, you know, cheap beta? I mean, have people put on blinders when it comes to fees and they ignore performance?
I don't think anybody's ignoring performance. I think fees is a very reasonable, function to think through, and you know, any wise investor needs to think through that. And so that's totally, totally fine. I think, it really comes down to what are the financial advisors most comfortable with in terms of a format, and, you know, what enables them to get the diversification from a product perspective that they're really looking to do. And I think that the growth in the ETF world has certainly helped out on that. I think the ability to customize in the SMA world is really unparalleled versus where it was, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So that's really helped a lot of individual investors and, you know, financial advisors as well. So I think there are just a lot more options today than there were when it was really just an open-end fund world or individual bonds. And, you know, there were really your only two choices 20 years ago. Now, you know, these other choices are very significant and good ones.
Yeah. I mean, it's come at the cost of, I would say, richer ratios for the industry, right? Especially in the front end of the curve, as you've had this sort of proliferation of growth within the SMA industry.
Yeah, that's that is probably not going to stop anytime soon. I mean, we think about the SMA freight train, and it continues to roll along. And it's pretty impressive, and it's great for many, many clients. You know, I think the main benefit of the customization is, of course, they get to sort of dictate where they want to be from a rate perspective, from a credit risk perspective. You know, obviously the state specificity is very important for many clients out there. And then the individualization around, you know, tax loss harvesting is really the kicker when you can take a tax loss on an individual bond and have that flow directly through to the you know, bondholder. That's really powerful, as opposed to in a mutual fund. You know, if we book a loss within a mutual fund, that's fine, but that loss has to stay within the mutual fund to offset a future gain that we'll take in that fund. But at no point can we distribute that loss out to shareholders. So that's sort of the key, you know, distinction when you think about SMA investing versus mutual fund investing. And the reality is, you know, technology has helped large asset managers like us, you know, be able to customize a lot more than we were able to in the past.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen SMA flows grow, you know, depending on who you ask, anywhere from like $700 billion to $1 trillion. So it sounds like you don't see that slowing down anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost like 25% of the market.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the market cap of munis now is, I'm guessing it's somewhere around 3.7 trillion.
Yeah, about. Yeah.
Give or take. And so you figure, you know, open-end mutual funds are probably somewhere around 800 billion. And SMAs are probably a little bit higher than that. They're probably in that trillion or maybe even trillion plus type of range. So yeah, that's a significant shift for sure versus pre-2022. I would think that continues to evolve that way.
You know, I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about the age old argument of passive versus active. And, you know, one of the things that we found very interesting, we did a report on this a couple of weeks ago. When we looked at passive, we used some of the larger ETF complexes for munis as sort of our example of passive management. And when you sort of get down into the documents and you sort of look at what they're actually investing in, we saw that they were missing about 25 to 30% of the market from a credit exposure standpoint. You know, namely, they're not investing in higher ed or hospitals or AMT or natural gas or any of the things that are really sort of come up as more higher yielding areas. Do you think that's a big blind spot for investors, and that's something that they should be mindful of? And, you know, how do you think that translates over to sort of the selling point for active still?
Yeah, I think it's a huge blind spot. You know, if you think about our world here in munis, it's really a game of basis points, right?
Yes.
Investors are here for the tax exempt yield, period. We know that prices are going to fluctuate up and down, depending on what rates are doing, depending on what credit spreads are doing, that's fine. But ultimately, at the end of the day, this is all about the tax exempt yield over time, over a reasonable time horizon. And, you know, the ability to pick up 5, 10, 15, you know, 20 basis points on an overall absolute yield of maybe 3 or 4% is really significant. And you know, some of the things you just threw out there, higher ed, hospitals, you know, AMT bonds, prepaid gas bonds, it's much more than 5, 10, 20, you know, 25 basis points. A lot of this stuff is, you know, 50, 100, maybe 150 basis points over AAA types of bonds in the same, with, you know, within the same structure. And so, you know, I think it's a huge miss. And, you know, you would not want to do this blindly. You'd only want to do it with a, you know, with a big firm who has a big research group and a lot of focus on risk management. But yes, I think to exclude spread sectors like that within, especially within the investment grade space, is a huge miss. And so I think that's, you know, that'll continue to be, you know, a good source of the reason for demand in open end funds for sure. But it'll also be a good source of demand into SMAs that can avail themselves of those types of sectors.
Yeah. If you, to the extent that you're able to, see if you can open up the kimono a little bit and talk about the credit process at your shop. You know, like, how are you guys ensuring that sort of, you know, risk management and diversification guardrails set up so you guys are able to sort of dive into those sectors and do it in a way that's not endangering anyone, let's say?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's you know, credit risk is at the core of, you know, our risk management process. Obviously, you get two main angles of risk in fixed income all the time, and that's interest rate risk and credit risk. And there are lots of different subcategories for each of those. But credit risk is something that is, you know, really near and dear to my heart. That's where I started in my career as a research analyst for the first 5 years, as you said, here at Franklin Templeton.
Yeah.
Way long ago. But it's really the beauty of the muni market is just how, you know, sort of funky and unique and nuanced it is. And I think nowhere is that more true than in the credit space. You know, dozens of different sectors, you know, even within each sector, you know, you and I spoke about higher education just a little while ago. And even within a sector like that, you've got a million different little categories that, you know, can be researched and taken advantage of. So that's one of the things that I've always loved about the muni market is the more research you can do into it, the more little pockets of opportunity you can find. Jen Johnston here at Franklin, you know, heads up our research group within our muni department. And she's got all the research analysts here, you know, organized by sector. And most of the sectors are covered by at least one, if not two, and sometimes even three people in terms of spillover from different sectors to make sure we have, you know, proper coverage. But yeah, we spend an awful lot of time making sure that, you know, we feel really good about our research process. It's a very intense process that, you know, really varies in terms of the credit quality of the individual bond. But, you know, in a lot of circumstances, you know, certainly down the credit spectrum, you know, it'll eventuate into a full credit committee discussion that includes, you know, a whole handful of portfolio managers here at Franklin, as well as, you know, everybody from the research side of the team as well. And it's a, you know, a very lively, healthy debate that we'll have, you know, and ultimately get into just an overall risk return type of analysis.
You know, as someone with a credit fundamentals background, I want to stand up and do like a slow clap right now hearing that explanation, because I feel like the pendulum's really swung hard the other way over the last 4 or 5 years, where credit fundamentals have really sort of gone by the wayside for a lot of shops as they've rushed to sort of invest money that's come in, especially on the SMA side. And, you know, credit due diligence has really sort of taken a back seat and more of like waving structure in than anything else.
Well, I feel like absolutely, credit research is a critical part of, you know, municipal bond portfolio management, and a lot of that has been helped quite a bit with technology, you know, over the last 10 years, really even over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, where, you know, big data dumps are much more available today than they were several years ago, and modeling component of, you know, what you can create from a data dump of, say, for example, school districts in the state of California, for example, that have a lot of similarities, you know, something like that is perfectly prime for a model-based approach to research. And what it really allows you to do more than anything else is to see where the outliers are and see where you really need to spend, you know, human intervention research time on those individual credits, even within, you know, the high-quality sectors.
You know, you mentioned interest rate risk management. I was wondering, you know, how much of a threat is these higher interest rates on discount coupon structures?
Ooh, the minimization.
The minimization. Yeah. You know, it's a great topic because it's something to be very wary of, and it's something to be opportunistic and on the offensive, you know, about, you know, when things line up just right as well. One of the very handy things on Bloomberg, obviously, is to be able to look at, you know, where QTAX is and where the after-tax analysis really, you know, gets set up for each bond out there. There are many buyers, of course, that won't touch anything that is beyond that threshold of market discount. If you have the ability to, you know, obviously, you look at stuff on an after-tax basis, and if it's attractive on an after-tax basis, and then some, given the lower liquidity that those bonds can have. Yeah. A lot of times those can be fantastic opportunities. You know, obviously, there's a lot of stuff floating out there in terms of cost basis in funds that was purchased, you know, at a lower price than the market discount threshold. And so there's a lot of accretion that's taken place that is, you know, accreting taxable income. So I think it's going to be an interesting thing over the next couple of years as people make the decision, is it better to book a capital gain and get rid of the accretion on the you know, taxable income that you're accreting in your funds? Or is it more painful to have the capital gains? In a lot of situations, if you have a ton of capital loss carry forwards, the capital gains hit is not so bad, and you can get rid of that taxable accretion, you know, on funds that you purchased below the market discount threshold. So it's a really interesting dynamic that is going to be front and center really for the next couple of years, especially if we sort of maintain in this range of rates and or even, you know, rally.
It's interesting because I feel like a lot of investors, I'm just talking about, you know, retail investors in single bonds, let's say, had no idea that you could actually get a tax bill from buying a discount muni. And it came to a surprise for many last year and then the year before, you know, when they were sort of launching into these, you know, three handle bonds, and they found out they had a capital gain at some point. So, I mean, do you think that this is a conversation that's like everybody's sort of comfortable with at this point, or you think we're still in sort of the education phase?
Oh, I think education wise at the retail level, I would think the education level is quite low still.
Oh man. Okay.
which again, for long-term investors and for, you know, for us on the institutional side, this is a great thing. We love the inefficiencies and the sloppiness of the muni market. That's one of the best things that we have going as institutional investors, is the fact that we get to be institutional investors in a retail driven asset class, and the sloppiness and the nuance, you know, are some of the best opportunities that we have in this market. And it could be structurally like what we're talking about here with market discount. It could be something like, you know, California has had a terrible drought for 3-4 years in a row, so sell all your water bonds in California, that type of thing. and we've seen that movie a million times before.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, we've seen a few headlines with California and the budget deficits that they're having. So I wanted to get your insight on, you know, are there any concerns with what we're seeing, the headlines coming through for California? But also, do you see that bleeding over to any other areas of the municipal market?
It's a great question, because earlier in the conversation, we talked about, you know, with SMA flows being so significant, you know, isn't it interesting that tax exempt or taxable equivalent yields are still so high in California? Mm-hmm. And you know, I think it's really interesting when you think about California, because there's no doubt it's tougher times economically in California now than it was 2-4 years ago. Sure. You know, we're sitting here at a AA2, AA- rating for the state of California. We're entering into a time frame where, you know, deficits are going to be quite large. Budget balancing will be, you know, more difficult for sure, and there are lots of challenges going forward. The question is it enough to create a downgrade type of scenario? And so that's debatable. We think that, you know, maybe, sure. You know, if they get downgraded to, you know, one notch to AA3 to A+, what does that mean from a spread perspective on CalGO? And the answer is probably not too much.
Yeah.
You know, the real question is overall for California, when you look across the landscape of California, you know, Cal Munis, especially in the short end, again, due to massive SMA demand, short end, high quality California bonds are, you know, they seem exceedingly rich relative to nationally diversified bonds of similar structure.
Correct. You
know, is that enough to sort of knock California off the pedestal from a spread perspective? And that's, I think, a much more appropriate question. You know, it's interesting because for a lot of, you know, clients that are California based and paying taxes here in California, I think it's very worthwhile to take a look at the yield that they're getting in their California munis or their California, you know, specific fund, and look at a national equivalent and just see how you're set up on an after-tax basis. In a lot of circumstances, it could be beneficial to move into a nationally diversified portfolio as opposed to a California specific portfolio.
That's a very confusing point to try and get someone's mind around if they're a California resident and they've been buying Cal bonds their whole life.
Yeah, and I think that that's true. But, you know, if you think about just the simple math of it, if you, you know, in most circumstances, you'd have to give up a little bit from an after-tax yield perspective to go into a national portfolio versus Cal.
Yeah.
In the situation in which you can break even on an after-tax basis, in my opinion, that's a no-brainer to go into the more diversified portfolio. In many situations, it is really possible on an after-tax basis to actually pick up yield in a nationally diversified portfolio relative to Cal. And so, you know, if you've got that type of situation and you're looking at these big deficits here coming up in Cal, I think it's pretty compelling to look at that math of Cal specific versus nationally diversified.
You know, we're running on time, getting close to the end here. And I just want to finish with like two questions, more big picture things, right? So to the extent that you could share with us, what are some areas of the market that you're really jazzed up about for the remainder of this year, you know, sector wise?
You know, I think, you know, some of the sectors that we have been very interested in over the last couple of years, and we continue to show a lot of interest, you know, are some of the sectors that still maintain some level of cheapness that they really picked up during the COVID lockdown. You know, student housing continues to be a sector that overall is fairly beaten down. I think there are lots and lots of unique good opportunities in the student housing sector, and so we'll continue to look around there. I would say on other things in the housing world, you know, there's been a lot of press over the last couple of years on a lot of the essential housing, workforce housing, other multifamily housing. And, you know, it's really interesting when you dig into those sectors and you think through, you know, the biggest, you know, bugaboo that we've got in fixed income, which is, of course, inflation. You know, inflation is a tough thing from a rate perspective. Inflation can be a great thing from a rent inflation perspective. And I think a lot of the multifamily housing projects, especially in the workforce housing sector, have really benefited from, you know, inflated rents versus even just the last couple of years. So that's a sector that has clearly been beaten down from a rate perspective. But from a credit fundamental perspective, some of those, there's some really neat opportunities in that sector as well.
So no, Eric, I know you were trying to wrap up, but I have one last question, and it's a selfish one. Since we have one day left here in San Francisco, what's your favorite restaurant?
Ooh, yes, that is pretty important.
Oh boy, if you haven't been to Tadich Grill, you're supposed to go there because that's one of the oldest in the city, and you'll get a good clam chowder and some other fish for lunch, and you'll of course have a either a Sierra Nevada or an Anchor Steam. So that's always going to be a favorite. Otherwise, a very strong recommendation would be to go over to the East Bay to Berkeley and try to get into Alice Waters' restaurant, Chez Panisse. So that would be a very strong recommendation.
All right. Karen's jotting this down as we speak.
Yeah, I really am.
Yeah, I know you are. All right, Ben, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate the conversation. And as always, join us next month on Masters of the Universe. Thank you.